Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our family meeting for our whole program today, Our Noisy Lives. And now from the 311 complaints of noisy New York to a much deeper history of our relationship with noise and sound. David Hendy is here, former BBC reporter and now a professor of media and communications at the University of Sussex. Last year, he produced Noise, A Human History, a 30-part BBC series, yes, 30-part, that explores what he calls a social history of noise. There's also a companion book of the same name. And David Hendy, welcome to WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hello, yes.
And listeners, hello. We're going to talk with David Hendy in a bit about the link between creativity and sound. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that some of you may have seen. So here's the question for you. Do you need silence to work or certain kinds of sound or noise? Are you the type who holds up and blocks everything out, or do you need the din in order to get the creative juices flowing? David Hendy has written a defense of working in noise, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. So start calling now about the link between creativity and noise or silence in your life. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I'm always amazed when some people say they listen to the show while they do creative work. Now, I could see it if you're a visual artist. If you're a writer, I don't think you could listen to a show like this. It would read as noise, I would think. But what kind of noise, what kind of sound do you like to listen to, if any, when you're trying to do creative work, whatever that work is? 212-433-9692. And while your calls are coming in, David Hendy, if we're going to do a little bit of a thumbnail history of human history and the social history of noise, let's start at the very beginning. Here is early music expert Igor Reznikov singing for you inside the caves at Arcy-sur-Cure in France, where some of the earliest cave paintings have been found. So, David, did sound like that help you better understand our earliest ancestors?
I think so. And, of course, when we're talking about our early ancestors, we're talking about tens of thousands of years ago, we have to admit, in the world of guesswork. But some of it is pretty informed guesswork by archaeologists and musicologists who have explored the passages of caves like those at Arcy-sur-Cure in France. And they've noticed that those parts of the caves which are particularly striking for an acoustic reason, because they have very strong reverberants or echoes, happen to be exactly the same points in the cave where we find art, prehistoric art. And we tend to think of prehistoric art as something which gives us a clue to the deep, distant visual culture. But it's possible to think of these images of animals, they're usually animals, as kind of markers identifying places where perhaps echoes were heard, if there was chanting or some kind of music being performed in these caves. And you can imagine that, you know, when you're in an era which doesn't have a firm grasp on the physical reasons for an echo coming from a cave wall will sound in many respects like a new voice, a new sound coming from behind a veil, in a way, coming from another realm. So there is you can start to imagine the possibility of caves being places where sound was played with and experimented with.
All right, let's jump ahead, 25,000 years, because you write a fair amount about ancient Rome, and it seems like it's the first example of what we can start to think of as modern-sounding noise. And I should say this is a reference to your book, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening, which is a companion to the BBC series. So describe what ancient Rome sounded like.
Well, it was pretty noisy, and it was especially noisy at night. I mean, you're talking about a city which, you know, was about a million people. I mean, it was the biggest city there had been so far in human history. And it was also a melting pot of a city. This was at the center of an empire, which meant that it was a city that needed feeding and supplying, and the waste products needed to be taken away, and people would come visiting. So there was a constant flow of people in and out. And the elite of Rome were very clear that they didn't want the streets and the routes to be clogged up with deliveries during the day. So there was, for many years, an order that deliveries would only take place at night. I mean, you'd imagine it the other way around. Now, if you were a citizen of Rome and you were living in the thick of the city, you therefore had to put up with deliveries through the night. There would be cattle that would be kind of ushered in and being pushed through the streets of Rome on the way to slaughter. There would be street hawkers, there were gyms. There's some very, very vivid descriptions from writers of the time about the shrieks and the cries of the street hawkers and the yelps and the slapping of flesh that you could hear coming from gyms. So it was a kind of roiling, bubbling, babbling soundscape.
It's a fascinating description, and compared to modern urban life today, we did some comparisons earlier between the sounds of New York today and the sounds of New York in the 1920s with some archival tape, just as loud but different. And so you're describing ancient Rome. And I wonder if from your research, people always made the distinction between sound and noise in the way we do today, or if that's a more modern construct. And if people in ancient Rome, given what you just described, thought of silence ever as a commodity.
I think that, it's a reasonable constant through history that some sounds have been welcome more than others. There are certain, if you think of noise as a sound that's out of place, that's one useful definition. But another one of noise is it's a sound that someone somewhere doesn't want to hear. And you touched on this earlier, that actually noise is only partly about decibels and loudness. It is about a sound that in some sense irritates. And you can imagine that particularly as people live closer and closer together, jumbled up in cities through the centuries with less and less space, then the issue of other people's sounds becomes more and more of a problem. One of the things that I would say that is quite striking from history is that in many respects, if things work out and you don't have one particular noise that's dominating, and that therefore what you're talking about is just the noise of lots of people living together, but a kind of fairly evenly distributed noise, there is very often a tolerance of that. And what's interesting is that when the rich moved away from sources of noise, and in ancient Rome they'd say move up to the Palatine Hill, or in 18th century Edinburgh they'd move to the new town. When they moved away and they didn't mix so much with poorer people, tolerance decreased. In other words, they got so used to quiet that quiet became more of a virtue, and noise became something that they regarded as vulgar and unpleasant, a bit like smell.
It sounds very much like the modern world. And we'll take calls in just a second. Our lines are full with people wanting to talk about whether you like to do creative work in silence or in what kind of noise environment, with David Hendy. And it's clear that you want to push back at the general sense that we have that the past was quieter than the present. And I know there's this really cool companion piece to your BBC series in which you asked an electronic musician to retell the entire history of noise in sound, and he does this sort of 14-minute audio tour for you. So we selected at random 3 points in the piece. Here is, from the beginning, prehistoric times. And his representation from the middle, probably around the 1500s. And from the end, say the post-industrial revolution period. the archaic sounds of typewriters. So what did those three taken together represent, very briefly?
Well, that was very much a mix put together by a musician, very much his own interpretation. But it seems to me that what you're dealing with here is a kind of, there's an eternal struggle as well as a benign relationship between humanity and natural sound. And I think one of the things that I think we were trying to convey in the series, that if you think of the noise of machinery, most of us can agree that a lot of that is unpleasant and intrusive, and we'd like to minimize it. But there is also a lot of sounds in history that come from human beings, fellow human beings, that have in the past been thought of as noise because they've been exotic or unusual or alien and mystifying. And so one of the things that we were trying to do, both in that kind of musical composition and in the series as a whole, was to explore the idea of trying to get behind something, a noise that seems alien and mystifying, to understand it from within. And therefore, in the process, it starts to cease to be noise. And you can think about this in terms of, you know, musical taste. You know, what we like is music, what other people like is noisy. And yet, if you can transcend that instinct, if you can start to learn about a music, you tend to appreciate it more. I mean, you know, fans of classical music say this: if you can learn about it, you can appreciate it. And I think that applies to sounds both natural and human, even if we can't quite bring ourselves to kind of really appreciate modern machine noise.
Jessica in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jessica. How do you like to do your creative work, and what kind of sound environment?
Hi, Brian. I'm a theater director, so I like noise that presses in, noise that can make the world feel a little bit smaller and lets my mind be a little bit more expansive. I'm working on a project now that involves sound in the city, and as part of that project, I sent out a questionnaire to friends and theater artists about how they work and what kinds of sound, how they feel about sound in the world. And it was fascinating. The groups divided pretty evenly into people who love noise, and to not have it, it makes them anxious. And then there are the people who just, it's too much, and they need something with a little bit more rhythm to it. And if they feel jarred at all, they can't focus. So our focus has been with this production, with State of Play Productions, in terms of finding out how sound fits into the muchness of the world and how much we pay attention to it.
Beautiful. Thank you. Justin in Fort Greene. You're on WNYC. Hi, Justin.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
All right.
Good. So I just wanted to call in and say that I appreciate a lot of the noises in the city. I live downstairs from somebody who's a film editor. And, you know, I hear a lot of sub-bass coming down from upstairs sometimes. I also live not too far away from Fort Greene Park. And there are concerts during the summer. But I moved to the city because it's a creative place, and I wanted to be creative. And I'm happy that there are people that are here that are doing their thing. And if it's a little bit noisy sometimes, I think that's okay. I expected that when I moved here, and I think other people should expect that when they move here as well.
Justin, thank you so much. Dimitri in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi, hello. I just wanted to say, whenever I do any sort of intellectual exercise, which is mostly reading for me, I love listening to music, but it either has to be really bad pop that doesn't make any sort of impression on me.
Huh.
It's just a rhythmic noise in the background, or any sort of chill-out electronic music with minimal lyrics. But on a few occasions, I've tried to read a difficult text while listening to one of my jazz or classical records, and it's a complete disaster.
So
it just doesn't work.
In other words, nothing good.
Any sort of good music vies for my attention.
That's great. Does that ring a bell with you, David Hendy, when you think about your own creative work? If you're listening to music, is it better if it's bad music because you don't get drawn into the content?
Yeah, I think two of your callers now have used almost exactly the same word, which is rhythm. The music has to be rhythmic in some way, and this goes back to the invention of background music, piped music. Back in the 1920s, when the French composer Eric Satie was in a restaurant trying to have a meal with his friend Fernand Léger, the painter, and was getting really irritated by the sound of the band, it was too intrusive, and he left that meal planning the idea of what he called furniture music, and he basically used fragments of popular melodies but remixed and repeated over and over again. And that's what works, that kind of rhythmic music, because of course our hearing brain is constantly on the alert for something unusual and different. So when it kind of notices that, well, nothing unusual and different, it's kind of recurring pattern here, it can kind of switch off, that cocktail party effect of kind of acknowledging that it's there but pushing it in the background takes over. And when something is kind of striking, then that's when the problem starts.
Daisy in Nassau County, you're a writer, Daisy?
Yes, I write short stories, and I'm also a law student. When I am writing, I need a calamity of activity. So I have the TV on something that I'm going to ignore. I typically have something on the stove. I'm cooking. I'm also doing laundry. So I have the hum of the washing machine in the background. I have the boiling and the simmering of the stove. And something that I can hear, that I can be drawn to, but then I can also tune out as I'm writing. When I'm doing work related to my law school, I usually just have the television on, anything. And gradually as I'm getting into the text, I'll put the volume lower and lower so that I can sort of refocus. But I take breaks based on what I hear coming from the television. I do that all the time.
That is quite a cacophony. But if you're a writer, how do you write with talking in the background on television, presuming there's talking?
Right. It helps me. A lot of times, if I get swept up in the story, I'll also be caught up in other thoughts. So another thought will creep into my mind, and that will take away from the story. Whereas if I have the TV going on, I can refocus on that sound that's going on in the background without being drawn into it, and then I can go back to my story. It also helps me with taking breaks. I can be seated for hours at a time and forget that the world is even there. But I have a moment to then get up, check the stove, get up, check the washing machine, and then I can go back to what I was doing.
That's wild. And you said you're in law school. How are you going to deal with the silence of the courtroom?
Oh, it's deadening so far. I've had that experience. I focus on different sounds. So I'll focus on the echoes in the halls. I'll focus on the calamity from the DAs, from behind the doors. So I focus on many different things, paper shuffling, pens scribbling on legal pads. I focus on a lot of different sounds when I'm in that environment. But I do notice that it is deadening.
Amazing. Daisy, thank you for your call. And we're just about out of time, but David Hendy, thinking about your op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, where you wanted a pushback against Thoreau, who went out to Walden Pond so he could work in silence, or Jonathan Franzen, who you referred to, who likes to turn on a pink noise machine so that he could write without the usual world sounds intruding. And you wanted to push back on that. And boy, it looks like you're in friendly company among our listeners.
Well, yes. I mean, I would say in a way I was quite sympathetic to Thoreau, because I think that one of the things I was trying to explore was the idea that, in fact, he didn't actually go in search of silence. He went in order for all the other sounds which might otherwise be ignored or overheard or missed, for them to bloom. So he could actually enjoy the sound of the pitch pines rubbing and creaking against the shingles and the cry of the birds. So it really isn't about silence. The thing is that it's about creating the space for a whole load of other noises, if you like, other sounds that we otherwise miss, to kind of have their day in the sun.
And before you go, in our last 15 seconds, as a historian of the world through sound, is there one particular moment in history you would most want to be able to listen to?
Well, I suppose I would love to be able to go back to the very, very deep, distant past. I would love to know actually what happened in these echoey caves. Are we right in imagining that this was somewhere where we can perhaps detect the origin of both music and religion through sound?
David Hendy, who did a social history of Sound for the BBC, a 30-part series, and has a companion book, Noise, A Human History of Sound and Listening. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next on our family meeting, Our Noisy Lives. What happens when our lives stop being noisy because we can't hear that well? We're actually going to talk about hearing loss, including a story from several people I know with hearing loss who say they're surprised at how loud it is. Stay with us.